The Dialogue of St. Catherine of Siena. Introduction by Alger Thorold. It would be hard to say whether the age of the saints, le moyen âge énorme et délicat, has suffered more at the hands of friends or foes. It is at least certain that the medieval period affects those who approach it in the manner of a powerful personality who may awaken love or hatred, but cannot be passed over with indifference. When the contempt of the 18th century for the subject, the result of that century's lack of historic imagination, was thawed by the somewhat rhetorical enthusiasm of Chateaubriand and of the Romanticists beyond the Rhine, hostility gave place to an undiscriminating admiration. The shadows fell out of the picture. The medieval time became a golden age when heaven and earth visibly mingled, when Christian society reached the zenith of perfection, which constituted it a model for all succeeding ages. Then came the German professors, with all the paraphernalia of scientific history, and looking through their instruments, we, who are not Germans, have come to take a more critical and perhaps a juster view of the matter. The Germans, too, have had disciples of other nations, and though conclusions on special points may differ, in every country now at a certain level of education, the same views prevail as to the principles on which historical investigation should be conducted. And yet, while no one with a reputation to lose would venture on any personal heresy as to the standards of legitimate evidence, the same facts still seem to lead different minds to differing appreciations. For history, written solely ad narrandum, is not history. The historian's task is not over when he has disinterred facts and established dates. It is then that the most delicate part of his work begins. History, to be worthy of the name, must produce the illusion of living men and women, and in order to do this successfully, must be based not only upon insight into human nature in general, but also upon personal appreciation of the particular men and women engaged in the episodes with which it deals. With facts as such, there can indeed be no tampering, but for the determination of their significance, of their value, as illustrative of a course of policy or of the character of those who were responsible for their occurrence, we have to depend in great measure on the personality of the historian. It is evident that a man who lacks the sympathetic power to enter into the character that he attempts to delineate will hardly be able to make that character live for us. For in art, as well as life, sympathy is power. Now, while this is true of all history whatever, it is perhaps truer of the history of the Middle Ages than that of any more recent period, nor is the reason of this far to seek. The Middle Ages were a period fruitful in great individuals who molded society, to an extent that perhaps no succeeding period has been. In modern times, the formula, an abstraction such as capital or the rights of man, has largely taken the place of the individual as a plastic force. The one great tyrant of the 19th century found his opportunity in the anarchy which followed the French Revolution. The spoil was then necessarily to the strong. But even Napoleon was conquered at last rather by a conspiracy of the slowly developing anonymous forces of his time than by the superior skill or strength of an individual rival. The lion could hardly have been caught in such meshes in the Trecento. Then the fate of populations was bound up with the animosities of princes, and in order to understand the state of Europe at any particular moment of that period, it is necessary to understand the state of soul of the individuals who happened, at the time, to be the political stakeholders. It must not be thought, however, that the personality of the prince was the only power in the medieval state, for the prince himself was held to be ultimately amenable to an idea which so infinitely transcended earthly distinctions as to level them all in relation to itself. Religion was in those days a mental and social force which we, in spite of the petulant acerbity of modern theological controversies, have difficulty in realizing. Prince and serf would one day appear as suppliants before the judgment seat of Christ, and the theory of medieval Christianity was considerably in favor of the serf. The father of Christendom, at once priest and king, anointed and consecrated as the social exponent of the divine justice, could not in his own person escape its rigors, but must one day render an account of his stewardship. Nor did the medieval mind, distinguishing between the office and the individual, by any means shrink from contemplating the fate of the faithless steward. In a last judgment by Angelico at Florence, the ministers of justice seem to have a special joy in hurrying off to the pit popes and cardinals and other ecclesiastics. For it is an insufficient criticism that has led some to suppose that the medieval church weighed on the conscience of Christendom solely, or even primarily, as an arbitrary fact. That the priesthood, aided by the ignorance of the people, succeeded in establishing a monstrous claim to control the destinies of the soul by quasi-magical agencies and the powers of excommunication. Nothing can be further from the truth. Probably at no period has the Christian conscience realized more profoundly that the whole external fabric of Catholicism, its sacraments, its priesthood, its discipline, was but the phenomenal expression, necessary and sacred in its place, of the idea of Christianity, that the vitality of that idea was the life by which the Church lived, and that by that idea all Christians, priests as well as laymen, rulers as well as subjects, would at the last be judged. When Savonarola replied to the papal legate, who in his confusion committed the blunder of adding to the formula of excommunication from the church militant a sentence of exclusion from the church triumphant, "You cannot do it," he was in the tradition of medieval orthodoxy. Moreover, even though the strict logic of her theory might have required it, the hierarchical church was not considered as the sole manifestation of the divine will to Christendom. The unanimity with which the Christian idea was accepted in those times made the saint a well-known type of human character, just as nowadays we have the millionaire or the philanthropist. Now the saint, although under the same ecclesiastical dispensation as other Christians, was conceived to have his own special relations with God, which amounted almost to a personal revelation. In particular, he was held to be exempt from many of the limitations of fallen humanity. His prayers were of certain efficacy. The customary uniformities of experience were thought to be constantly transcended by the power that dwelt within him. He was often accepted by the people as the bearer to Christendom of a divine message over and above the revelation of which the hierarchy was the legitimate guardian. Not infrequently, indeed, that message was one of warning or correction to the hierarchy. Sabatier points out truly that medieval saints occupied much the same relation to the ecclesiastical system as the prophets of Israel had done, under the older dispensation, to the Jewish priesthood. They came out of their hermitages or cloisters, and with lips touched by coal from the altar, denounced iniquity wherever they found it, even in the highest places. It is needless to say that they were not revolutionaries. Had they been so, indeed, the state of Europe might have been very different today. For them, as for other Christians, the organization of the church was divine. It was by the sacred responsibilities of his office that they judged the unworthy pastor. An apt illustration of this attitude occurs in the life of the Blessed Columba of Rieti. Columba, who was a simple peasant, was called to the unusual vocation of preaching. The local representatives of the Holy Office, alarmed at the novelty, imprisoned her and took the opportunity of a visit of Alexander VI to the neighboring town of Perugia to bring her before His Holiness for examination. When the saint was brought into the Pope's presence, she reverently kissed the hem of his garment, and being overcome with devotion at the sight of the Vicar of Christ, fell into an ecstasy, during which she invoked the divine judgment on the sins of Rodrigo Borgia. It was useless to attempt to stop her. She was beyond the control of inquisitor or guards. The Pope had to hear her out. He did so, proclaimed her complete orthodoxy, and set her free with every mark of reverence. In this highly characteristic episode, scholastic logic appears for once to have been justified at perilous odds of her children. Midway between sky and earth hangs a city beautiful, Siena, Vetus Civitas Virginis. The town seems to have descended as a bride from airy regions and lightly settled on the summits of three hills, which it crowns with domes and clustering towers. As seen from the vineyards which clothe the slopes of the hills, or with its crenellated wall and slender-necked campanile silhouetted against the evening sky from the neighboring heights of Belcaro, the city is familiar to students of the early Italian painters. It forms the fantastic and solemn background of many a masterpiece of the Trecentisti, and seems the only possible home, if home they can have on earth, of the glorified persons who occupy the foreground. It would create no surprise to come, while walking round the ancient walls, suddenly at a turn in the road, on one of the sacred groups, so familiarly recurrent to the memory in such an environment. Indeed, one experiences a curious illusion when a passing friar happens for a moment to compose with cypress and crumbling archway. Siena, once the successful rival of Florence in commerce, war, and politics, has, fortunately for the more vital interests which it represents, long desisted from such minor matters. Its worldly ruin has been complete for more than 500 years. In truth, the town has never recovered from the plague, which in the far-off days of 1348 carried off 80,000 of its population. Grassy mounds within the city walls mark the shrinking of the town since the date of their erection, and Mr. Murray gives its present population at less than 23,000. The Free Ghibelline Republic, which on that memorable 4th of September 1260, defeated with the help of Pisa at Monte Aperto the combined forces of the Guelph party in Tuscany, has now, after centuries of servitude to Spaniard and Austrian, to be content with the somewhat pinchbeck dignity of an Italian prefectura. At least the architectural degradation which has overtaken Florence at the hands of her modern rulers has been as yet in great measure spared to Siena. Even the railway has had the grace to conceal its presence in the folds of olive which enwrap the base of the hill on which the city is set. Once inside the rose-colored walls, as we pass up the narrow, roughly paved streets between lines of palaces, some grim and massive like Casa Tolomei, built in 1205, others delicate specimens of Italian Gothic like the Palazzo Saracini, others again illustrating the combination of grace and strength which marked the domestic architecture of the Renaissance at its prime, like the Palazzo Piccolomini, we find ourselves in a world very remote indeed from anything with which the experience of our own utilitarian century makes us familiar. And yet, as we rub our eyes, unmistakably a world of facts, though of facts, as it were, visibly interpreted by the deeper truth of an art whose insistent presence is on all sides of us. Here is Casa Tolomei, a huge cube of rough-hewn stone stained to the color of tarnished silver with age, once the home of that Madonna Pia, whose story lives forever in the verse of Dante. Who shall distinguish between her actual tale of days and the immortal life given her by the poet? In her moment of suffering, at least, she has been made eternal. And not far from that ancient fortress home, in a winding alley that can hardly be called a street, is another house of medieval Siena. No palace this time, but a small tradesman's dwelling. In the 14th century, it belonged to Set Giacomo Benincasa, a dyer.
Part of it now has been converted into a chapel, over the door of which are inscribed the words, Sponse Christi Catharinae Domus. Here, on March 5, 1347, being Palm Sunday, was born Giacomo's daughter Caterina, who still lives, one of the purest glories of the Christian Church, under the name of St. Catherine of Siena. More than 500 years have passed since the daughter of the Sienese dyer entered into the rest of that sublime and touching symbolism under which the Church half veils and half reveals her teaching as to the destiny of man. Another case, but how profoundly more significant than that of poor Madonna Pia, of the intertwining of the world of fact with the deeper truth of art. St. Catherine was born at the same time as a twin sister, who did not survive. Her parents, Giacomo and Lapa Benincasa, were simple townspeople, prosperous and apparently deserving their reputation for piety. Lapa, the daughter of one Muzio Piagenti, a long, now wholly forgotten poet, bore 25 children to her husband, of whom 13 only appear to have grown up. This large family lived together in the manor still obtaining in Italy, in the little house, till the death of Giacomo in 1368. There are stirring pages enough in Christian hagiology. Who can read unmoved of the struggles towards his ideal of an Augustine or a Loyola, or of the heroic courage of a Teresa, affirming against all human odds the divinity of her mission, and justifying, after years of labor, her incredible assertions by the steadfastness of her will? There are other pages in the lives of the saints, less dramatic it may be, but breathing, nevertheless, a naive grace and poetry all their own. The childhood of those servants of Christ who have borne his yoke from the dawn of their days forms their charming theme. Here the blasting illuminations of the revelation are toned down to a soft and tender glow, in which the curves and lines of natural humanity do but seem more pathetically human. The hymn at Lourdes for the Feast of the Holy Innocents represents those unconscious martyrs as playing with their palms and crowns under the very altar of heaven. Vos prima Christi victima, grex immolatorum tener, aram sub ipsam simplices, palma et coronis luditis. And so these other saintly babies play at hermits or monasteries instead of the soldiers and housekeeping beloved of more secular-minded infants. Heaven condescends to their pious revels. We are told of the blessed Hermann Joseph, the premonstratensian, that his infantile sports were joyously shared by the divine child himself. He would be a morose pedant indeed, who should wish to rationalize this white mythology. The tiny Catherine was no exception to the rest of her canonized brothers and sisters. At the age of 5, it was her custom on the staircase to kneel and repeat a Hail Mary at each step, a devotion so pleasing to the angels that they would frequently carry her up or down without letting her feet touch the ground, much to the alarm of her mother, who confided to Father Raymond of Capua, the Dominican confessor of the family, her fears of an accident. Nor were these phenomena the only reward of her infant piety. From the day that she could walk, she became very popular among her numerous relatives and her parents' friends, who gave her the pet name of Euphrosyne to signify the grief-dispelling effect of her conversation, and who were constantly inviting her to their houses on some pretext or other. Sent one morning on an errand to the house of her married sister Bonaventura, she was favored with a beautiful vision, which, as it has an important symbolical bearing on the great task of her afterlife, I will relate in Father Raymond's words, slightly abridging their prolixity. So it happened that Catherine, being arrived at the age of 6, went one day with her brother Stephen, who was a little older than herself, to the house of their sister Bonaventura, who was married to one Niccolo, as has been mentioned above, in order to carry something or give some message from their mother Lapa. Their mother's errand accomplished, while they were on their way back from their sister's house to their own, and were passing along a certain valley, called by the people Valle Piatta, the Holy Child, lifting her eyes, saw on the opposite side, above the church of the preaching friars, a most beautiful room, adorned with regal magnificence, in which was seated, on an imperial throne, Jesus Christ, the Savior of the world, clothed in pontifical vestments, and wearing on his head a papal tiara. With him were the princes of the apostles, Peter and Paul, and the holy evangelist John. Astounded at such a sight, Catherine stood still, and with fixed and immovable look, gazed, full of love, on her Savior, who, appearing in so marvelous a manner, in order sweetly to gain her love to himself, fixed on her the eyes of his majesty, and with a tender smile lifted over her his right hand, and making the sign of the Holy Cross in the manner of a bishop, left with her the gift of his eternal benediction. The grace of this gift was so efficacious that Catherine, beside herself, and transformed into him upon whom she gazed with such love, forgetting not only the road she was on, but also herself, although naturally a timid child, stood still for a space with lifted and immovable eyes in the public road, where men and beasts were continually passing, and would certainly have continued to stand there as long as the vision lasted, had she not been violently diverted by others. But while the Lord was working these marvels, the child Stephen, leaving her standing still, continued his way downhill, thinking that she was following, but seeing her immovable in the distance, and paying no heed to his calls, he returned and pulled at her with his hands, saying, "What are you doing here? Why do you not come?" Then Catherine, as if waking from a heavy sleep, lowered her eyes and said, "Oh, if you had seen what I see, you would not distract me from so sweet a vision," and lifted her eyes again on high. But the vision had entirely disappeared, according to the will of him who had granted it, and she, not being able to endure this without pain, began with tears to reproach herself for having turned her eyes to earth. Such was the call of Saint Catherine of Siena, and to a mind intent on mystical significance, the appearance of Christ in the semblance of his vicar may fitly appear to symbolize the great mission of her after life to the Holy See. End of part 1 of the introduction.